Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today, all the way from across the pond, is Jake Arnott. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yep. All right.
Now, Jake is an award-winning novelist whose best-selling debut, The Long Firm, was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and was adapted as a BAFTA award-winning BBC TV drama series. And that must have been really exciting. His second novel, He Kills Coppers, was made into a critically acclaimed ITV1 series, and along with his third book, True Crime, this trilogy was awarded the Crime Writers Association Dagger in the Library. And he has written a few novels since then, and the one that we're talking about today is Blood Rival. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Jake.
I'm glad to be here. Lovely to see you.
So I was just asking you before we started where you were, and you said you were in Hastings, or very near Hastings. And of course, Hastings was the setting for Foyle's War.
Oh, yeah.
And the author of Foyle's War was a previous guest on Writer's Voices many, many years ago. Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, the book actually, Blood Rival. I lived in London for a long time, and a lot of my novels, not all of my novels, but a lot of my novels obviously are set in London. But this one's actually set in Kent, which is the county just across the border from here, which has a sort of quite an interesting history. But we'll probably touch upon that when we talk about the book.
So why, how is this book different from your previous books, other than the setting?
Well, I don't want to give too many spoiler alerts, but this book is a kind of, it's based on a classical Greek tragedy. So I kind of came across this idea for a story, which would I realized because as I was saying in the reading, it all happened at a place where three roads meet. That's the beginning. For those classically trained among you, I'll immediately give away. Yes, but I don't think it will spoil anything.
Actually. No, and actually there are not that many of us classically trained in the U.S. at least. So were you familiar with that before you started?
I was familiar with the story because it's quite a famous one.
Yes.
And what struck me was the inciting incident of the whole story is what we call an incident of road rage, where in the Greek story it's at a crossroads, these two men in chariots, one won't give way to the other, and a fight ensues, and that then sets all sorts of things in train. And so I took that incident. There was actually quite a very famous incident of road rage that involved a kind of older gangster figure, quite a famous skank. I won't mention his name here just because he's still alive.
And you don't want him coming after you.
I kill him off in this book, but he might do the same to me in real life. And he in the real story he kills the younger man, but in my story I turn it on his head. And so what then ensues is a kind of a, it's quite a sort of gangland story, that it's a struggle for power, but in the middle of it, it's also a story of forbidden love.
Right. And the thing that I find interesting is that unlike most, I'd say, kind of novels in this genre that I read, you don't have the hero's not necessarily a good guy.
No, I see, I think this is the thing that people forget in all good classic storytelling, that actually it's not the heroes that are important, it's the villains. If you look at Shakespeare, most of Shakespeare's central characters aren't heroes, they're villains. Even Hamlet, by the end of Hamlet, has become essentially a serial killer. It's the flaws in humanity that make us what are. And it's that, I suppose, going back to the notion of Greek tragedy, it's also that reversal where somebody bad can redeem themselves, or somebody good can fall from grace. And I think it's those sorts of stories that interest me.
And how do you sort of get inside the head of such a severely flawed person without having it affect you? Or can you?
No, well, I think actually allows us. I think how we identify with, I suppose, essentially in a modern sense, we call the anti-hero, is that allows us, it sets us free, really. Because, of course, we don't really want to do all these terrible things, but we also don't want to be stuck in a sense that we have to live a kind of a life that is bounded too much by convention. Yeah. So our imagination can take us to places, and we can try, and it's like a thought experiment. We think to ourselves, well, what would I do in those circumstances? I mean, all of us driven to the extremes will do extreme things. And I think it's interesting to think about what that actually means. And I think in a sense, that's one of the purposes of storytelling, is that we follow things in stories that we wouldn't necessarily want to happen to us, but we are curious to know how that affects the human condition.
Right, right. And we can, so you can learn about yourself without actually having to go through that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. We're lucky. We're very lucky in living lives where we can read, you know, when we actually have time to read, because reading allows us that, allows us to exercise our imagination and our empathy in trying to think about that, you know, what, because once you, when you read something, you are actually entering into the mindset of somebody else and trying to imagine how you would feel in that situation.
So now you've had several of your books made into TV series.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that they can have as much impact? Can it have as much impact in that form as it does in the written word?
I think it's a different experience. I think what I love about the novel, both writing and reading it, it's a very intimate experience. It's a one-to-one experience. It's the reader and the writer. I think, obviously, drama is much more collective. And there's a difference between film and TV and theatre. You know, film is actually, you know, when we go to the cinema, it's a very, very collective experience. And that's why we still like it. I mean, it's in decline, unfortunately. But it's a lovely way of sharing that experience, and it's in real time. We all experience it in the same time, so it's a different experience, I think. I mean, I'm biased. I love reading, and so I love writing, and I love being in that world. But I love all forms. I love all forms of storytelling. Actually, you know, any way of doing that is interesting, and how people just in day-to-day life tell stories is always interesting.
How did you start out as a novelist?
Well, that's a good question. I grew up thinking, I suppose it was something I've always felt instinctively drawn to when I was young, of telling stories. But I found high school education didn't really suit me. I in a sense, that's all I really wanted to do. And so I didn't get on very well at school.
Your teachers didn't appreciate all your stories.
After a while, the problem with education generally is it often lacks a creative element. And the school I went to was very, very uncreative. So I got into trouble quite early on. So I left school without graduating. And I did all sorts of things, actually. I kind of lived a wasted youth in a way. But I found myself again drawn to creative things. For a while, I was interested in acting. And I did try acting, but I wasn't a very good actor. I was too self-conscious. I realized by trying acting that actually what I really needed to do was go away and write, because I was thinking about my characters, not being them. Actors do something else. It's very particular. And I found it very hard to give up that sort of consciousness. But I'd always be thinking about the text rather than feeling it.
Okay, so you just decided to go off and write a book?
time, Monica. Anyway, I will tell you, it's a long time. I was drifting around, and I'd found myself in the north of England in a city called Leeds. I'd gone up there actually for a theatre job, and that's when I realised I couldn't really act anymore. Maybe I could never really act in the beginning. And I found myself, I got a job in social services doing care work. I sort of ended up working part-time, living very cheaply. I started writing a book that never got published. It took me about 5 years to write that. But then I learned, you know, it was a long, slow slog. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone who doesn't love writing. You know, I would live very, very cheaply. I would work two and a half days a week, get enough money to get by, and, find time to write. And eventually I got a publishing contract. It took me probably about, I suppose, all in all, when I seriously thought about it, to actually achieving it, it took me sort of anything between 8 or 9 years, you know, maybe 10 years. And before that, I'd been thinking about it.
What kept you motivated to keep writing during that time?
I think you've got to love it. I really do. I think if you, I don't, you know, even when I've had good years and bad years, and I, you know, but on a good day, I think I've got the best job in the world, and I couldn't be thinking, God, I'm not making any money this year.
So when you, okay, so that first book,
yeah,
it's really what you learned on. Essentially,
the one that didn't get published.
The one that didn't get published. Yes,
you learn from your mistakes. And that's
the sad thing. So, looking back on it, what was it that you, what made that book not good enough to publish? What did you learn from it?
Yeah, it's quite hard, you know, to determine. I think there's a danger when you're starting off writing. Like anything else, it's a bit like when you're starting to learn how to cook. The danger is you put everything in it, and you over spice things. I mean, I had lots of different ideas that I threw in. There was lots of things about my own life I threw in there as well. And I was struggling to find out. I was trying to learn on the job, really. And I think there probably wasn't quite enough focus to it.
Okay.
And if that makes any kind of sense, it does. It's very hard to determine. I always talk about, if I'm ever in that position where I'm teaching or talking about writing, I often talk about story, and it's very hard to determine what story is. Story isn't necessarily what happens; it's the feeling we get. We know it's a story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's different from plot. Plot is what happens to the characters, but story is what happens to the reader. It's that sort of feeling we get. We think, oh, yeah. I'm going along with this. I'm inside of this story.
That is a very good description. Mm. Yeah. So when you sit down to write a new book, are you starting with a concept of a plot, or are you starting with a character, or what is the initial seed?
Well, it's always different. But with this one, with Blood Rival, I started with this Greek story. I already had a structure. So it was, in a sense, it was almost like a template and a sense of how do I make this work? You know, how do I make this as a modern story, a believable story with real characters that's based on a myth, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that was a challenge in a way. But in a way, I was gifted this structure. And I think, you know, sometimes this was a very obvious use of structure. But I sometimes think we often have, it's often useful to have something, some vague sense, even if it's not completely like something else. But a sense of what it might be a little bit like in terms of structure. I suppose what I'm saying is I do tend to think about structure quite a lot.
Okay.
You know, some people build brick by brick. I tend to sort of put the scaffolding up. Not always, but that's generally how I think. I think, you know, I start to think about the whole thing, the whole edifice.
So in this case, you knew what the ending was because it was part of that.
Though I do change some of the things in the ending as well.
Okay.
I thought, oh, I can change. But yes, there was something there I could change.
Yeah. And is that usually the case when you start writing? Do you know what the ending is?
This is such a crucial question, Monica. It really is. It's so hard to say. I think the ending and the beginnings are the two things we can change the most sometimes, because it's an arbitrary. They're both very arbitrary. You know, where do you start the story? Where do you end the story? This story could go on a little bit longer, or it could end sooner.
Yeah.
So I think it can. I think you can often have a sense of the ending, and then change it.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, reading Blood Rival, that I did feel like You could have gone further with it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, or there could be a sequel.
there is in the Greek stories a trilogy. So you never know.
Okay. I did not realize that. Yeah. So, Jake, why don't you read? I think you were going to start with the opening. You're going to read.
I'm going to start the opening.
Yeah.
Why not? Hopefully, this will give a sort of sense of. It might give a sense of the book. I'm just going to. I'll just dive in, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
It happened at a place where three roads meet, Junction 1A of the M25, heading east towards Gravesend. There's a killer on the road. Just after dawn, on a bright June Sunday morning, Lee Royal was driving his dark blue Land Rover Discovery home from a long night in Essex. He crossed the water at Dartford, idly dreaming of his ancient homeland. Kent, he mused, as he changed down to ease into the slip road. Then a red Mazda MX-5 Roadster cut him up across the right-hand side, making his foot flinch sharply on the brake pedal. Lee raged and blared his horn. He flashed his headlights full beam and gave chase, gaining on the impotent little sports car as they approached a roundabout at the foot of the slope. As he overtook the MX-5, Lee glanced over to judge his tormentor. Just a kid, a boy racer, a baby driver. Royal caught the youth's eye and gazed a gorgon glare, but the kid just smiled back and gave him the finger and swerved around to block him off broadsides. The kid braked hard, his grin gritting as his head jerked back against the headrest. For a moment, all was quiet, but for the low drone of the motorway above and a light descant of birdsong from the embankment. Royal wondered if the dazed look on the kid's features was enough. He could drive off now, before the little bastard could recover his senses. But some impulse made him linger. That face. Something familiar about it. And he knew then that he needed more, to humiliate him properly, give the boy a slap if need be. Let baby driver know who was daddy. Just to make sure, he reached down beneath the driver's seat and pulled out a small sheath knife he kept there. He slipped it into the pocket of his zip-up jacket, opened the door, and climbed out onto the road. The kid was already out of his car and walking towards him. Again, Lee wondered if he knew him from somewhere. As he thought of all his enemies, Royal was glad he'd brought the blade with him. He stroked its outline gently through the cloth of his jacket as he turned to face his opponent. Get that thing out of my way, the kid called him. What's your hurry, son? Just move it. They closed in, circling each other in a lethal courtly dance, shaping up for combat. You want to watch yourself, sonny? He said the words softly, and for a curious moment felt a caring tone in his heart. This was just a hot-headed young man, after all, out of his depth. You don't know who I am, Lee warned him, with a grim smile. Off out of my way, the kid spat out the words, old man. Royal was in his late 50s, but had kept himself in shape, his loose limb frame tensed at this taunt. His forearms raised slowly, instinctively, he stepped forward. Someone ought to teach you some manners, he said. The kid bared his young chest and opened his arms in a beckoning gesture. "Yeah," he offered. "Come on, then." Royal's punch was intended to connect with the kid's chin and floor him in one, but he wasn't fast enough. Age had softened him. The younger man saw it coming, ducked and parried with his left, then came back under Lee's guard to deliver a sharp hook to the stomach. Royal doubled up, winded, choking, desperately trying to find his footing. Then another fist smashed into his face and he dropped down onto the tarmac. He managed to roll away and scramble to his feet before the kid could land a kick. Squatting low, Royal could taste blood as he fumbled for the knife in his pocket. As the kid loomed over him, ready to strike once more, Lee showed him the blade. "Want some of this?" he hissed, still out of breath. Royal always relished that look of fear on an opponent's face. He never spent too much time dealing with the brutal end of things. He'd survived by knowing the odds, when you might make a killing and when you might just have to walk away. And he'd prided himself on being utterly ruthless in business, happy to let others play at being the heavy, to cross the pavement to do a bank or a security firm, while he'd be the one that managed the proceeds. Let the suckers take the risks and do the time. His eye was always on the profit. This was the key to his success with the Tunbridge Wells cash depot robbery. But there was business and there was personal. And when the odds were right, he was never averse to taking somebody down, especially if that somebody had tried to have him over. And now this cocky little was backing away, trying to hide the terror in his stupid face. Now was the moment that mattered, because he had proved he could do it after all. He'd never been sure until that night, nearly 20 years ago, never been sure if he was a killer or not, until that night he found a man in his garden, the undercover cop spying on his house. He'd been upstairs making love to his wife, Jo. He'd been so powerfully primal that night. When he came, his whole being seemed to implode into darkness. Then, as he held his trembling body and caught his breath, he had heard the noise outside. He'd let the dog out and taken a knife from the kitchen. He hadn't meant to kill the man. It was instinctive. He told the arresting officer, "You ask Ray Spinks. He'll tell you I'm not a cold-blooded killer." But when the blood was up, he proved he could do it. And now, looking at the kid, he knew he could do it again. He pointed the blade at the boy in a deliberate gesture of intent, but he was distracted by the look on the young man's face in front of him. "Please," the kid implored, his hands up, his eyes darting about, looking for a way out. That look of fear usually made Royal feel bold, powerful, but something else happened. He hesitated. Something about the young man's expression made him think of Joe, the argument that they had the night before, and the dreadful thing he had made them do all those years ago. An awful, paralyzing sense of compassion took hold of him, and he felt his grip on the knife loosen. He lowered the blade. This might have been the most humane thing he had ever done in his life. It was almost an act of love. And this moment of weakness was all the kid needed. He kicked the weapon out of Royal's hand and knocked him to the ground once again. Picking up the knife, he stood above the older man. Lee looked up in horror as he suddenly realized what he recognized in his assailant, what he had feared all along. "No," he thought, "it's not possible." The young man looked wild about the eyes, drugged up or in some kind of trance, and Lee's mind struggled with the awful truth. Of all the people that might want him dead, Ray Spinks, Chris Ipsworth, even his own wife, this was the one person in the world who had the right to truly hate him. "Wait," he begged, but the knife came down again and again. As life's warmth bled out of him, Lee Royal thought of Joe once more. This was her revenge, perhaps. But what a curious way of taking it. With what Lee had always feared most, the killer inside, his blood rival. The assailant walked back to his car. He looked around briefly. No traffic around or CCTV covering this slip road. This abrupt and impulsive act would be hidden from sight, even from himself. He could forget it now, pretend it never happened. But as he drove away, he did not see the figure standing high up on the motorway embankment, the solitary witness who had watched it all happen.
And that was Jake Arnott reading from Blood Rival. So, Kent County.
Oh, yes.
So, what's special about Kent? Why choose that for the setting?
It chose me, really. I mean, what the place where three roads meet, there's a motorway that goes all the way round London called the M25. It's often called the London Orbital. And it's this big sort of carousel almost. And obviously, it's where a lot of things happen. In the past, I mean, it goes way back to smuggling days. You know, Kent and the coastline, that's where, you know, rum and silk and tobacco and tea would have been smuggled in. So there's a tradition of that county. It's sort of to the east of London. And I suppose a bit like New Jersey is to New York. It has sort of that sort of sense of a Badlands to it. And actually, the central character who we just heard, Lee Royal, is based on a real Kent gangster.
Whose name you will not mention.
he's getting quite old now. I actually, weirdly enough, I know it sounds absurd. I spoke to somebody once represented him legally the other day, and he's still around, but he's getting old now. So I don't think he'll come on.
So are there still gangs like that, gangsters operating in?
I think the thing to remember about organized crime, and it's often depicted wrongly in British crime fiction, because it's not like we've never really had something like a mafia here, and we don't tend to, although they're small criminal families, we don't have that big kind of Cosa Nostra thing, never have done. And actually, what we do have is much more pragmatic. You often have Lee Royal is actually a businessman. You know, he has a business front, and I think these are the most successful. The most successful gangsters are not the ones that are the most famous. People mm-hmm. always talk about the Cray twins, but the Cray twins actually dressed up like gangsters. They behaved like gangsters, and so they got caught quite early on. They weren't very good gangsters because they behaved like gangsters. The only way to be successful, as we know in crime, is to make it a business. Because essentially, crime is the most brutal form of capitalism. And, you know, I always love that. There's a great line in The Godfather where, the wife of the mob boss says, remember when you said in 5 years' time all the Corleone's all the Corleone's business would become legitimate. He said, yeah. And she said, that was 7 years ago. The tragedy of certain gangs is that they fail to become legitimate.
Mm.
And we can look around and we can see there's gangsters all the way around that aren't gangsters. As Bertolt Brecht said, what's robbing a bank compared to founding one? You really want to commit crime, you have to become serious about it, and you have to become a businessman. And there are certain and as we know, there are certain businessmen who are very, very powerful.
Yeah.
And you can become the most powerful man in the world if you're a businessman. That's the terrifying thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I am a business person, and I started a business that it's a manufacturing business, and I've got hundreds of employees around the world.
Yeah.
But I try and keep it very humane and very fair and just, and I think most people see it that way, but I will say also I also have a lot of sort of interaction with very successful businesses, and it is not that uncommon that the most successful businesses got that way by taking advantage of people in one way or another.
But then this is how we define success. You see, this is success in business is not necessarily success in life. We do things if you do things you love, it doesn't really, you know, that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
But if it's simply about power of money, it becomes something.
Yeah. Although I feel like the people who do focus on that love power and money.
I know.
Yeah.
And this is the thing I find quite difficult, because I don't, obviously we'd all like a bit more and this, but I don't really care that much about it.
I find it hard to understand why people who are extremely wealthy continue to do things, just they keep wanting more and more. It's like, why? What is it that you don't have now
exactly.
that having more money is going to get you? And they get so angry about paying taxes and about somebody else benefiting from their hard work. And it's like, well, you benefited from the hard work of everyone who worked for you. You know, and that's the way capitalism works. You are supposed to profit from the work of the people that you provide jobs for.
Yeah.
And if you didn't profit from it, you wouldn't be able to continue to provide those jobs. So it is, you know, it works, but there's a limit to how much anybody needs. And I just, it baffles me. And also the thing that the extremely wealthy sometimes seem to forget is if other people aren't prospering, if we don't have a strong middle class, if we don't have people who can afford to buy things, you're not going to have a business in 20 years because you won't have any customers because nobody can afford to buy what you're selling. So yeah. How does it benefit you to hoard all the money for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, this is one of the things I'm sort of looking at in the book to a certain extent. And the kingdom, I mean, in the Greek story, there's a notion of a kingdom inherited. And I suppose the kingdom is this sort of wealth, extreme wealth. And it can cause, you know, this can become an arena of ambition and betrayal and all of those lovely things we love in fiction. And we want to avoid in real life. I suppose.
Yeah. Now I'm not that familiar with the myth that you're retelling, other than the kind of main theme of it, which most people I think are. So there's a character in Blood Rival, Terry.
Yes.
Is he based on a particular character in that myth?
Yes, well, the great thing about Tiresias, who is based on, he turns up in all sorts of Greek myths. His blind transgender character. What I love about Greek mythology, it's incredibly diverse, and it has this wonderful sense that there's all sorts of characters there. It doesn't present them in any particularly politically correct or woke way. In a sense, it's a quite a brutal environment for everybody in Greek stories. But what is astonishing for me is the inclusivity, and even the women characters. Jo in Blood Rival is based on the woman protagonist, who does have a certain amount of agency in her life and is punished for that. Of course, everyone gets punished. Yeah, Terry, I saw this. Tiresias is one of those characters that will turn up in most Greek myths.
Okay.
He's constantly giving advice, or people come to him for advice, or them rather. I should be using correct pronouns, because he's genuinely non-binary. He moves from being male to female, and it's very interesting that people talk of, because of course trans issues is a big issue at the moment. But what it proves, this is something that's always existed. It's always existed in life, and it's always existed in the imagination, and it's always been seen as an important component of how we look at gender and how we look at sexuality. And again, Greek characters, they will have gay, bisexual, lesbian characters, they will have disabled characters, they will have, you know, refugees, all sorts of what I love is there's an opportunity to use existing stories in order to tell our own stories. And a sense that there's often this sense that the modern world is alien to us. There's something new and difficult and strange and frightening. But all of these things exist in our imagination. And they're all things that we can actually find ways of telling through story.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Well, there's always a new way of telling it.
There's a new way of telling it, yes.
That's the lovely thing. That's the lovely, and the wonderful thing is that you start to tell something and then you realize it's something that has already been told.
Well, it's interesting, like, you know, Shakespeare is considered one of the greatest storytellers of all time, and almost all of his, you know, he had really a very few plots, and they were all kind of this. A lot of the stories, there would be a shipwreck, there would be a somebody who was a man pretending to be a woman or a woman pretending to be a man. Mistaken identities. Mm-hmm. And there was always a fool. And there was a king or a prince or a duke or something, you know. So it was, but despite those similarities, what made all of those plays, it was actually the language that made Shakespeare great. It was the use of words. It wasn't the plot, like you say. It wasn't what happened to people. It was.
I think it was, and the character, the sense of the sense of. I think the sense of humanity.
Yes.
And I think the one like you were saying about how we identify with the villain. I think he was always able to do that. He's always able to allow us to experience every facet of human experience through sort of, and as you say, being able to use language in such a. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, it's the use of language actually allowed us to see things in a different way, because he would juxtapose two words that you'd never thought of together before, and then you realize what the connection is, or there's so many phrases that we use today that were originated by Shakespeare and aren't even aware of it. You know, that they became part of the common vernacular. So,
and I think as well, for me, I think his great success was that he operated on different levels. That he was extremely popular in his day, and even now, if a Shakespeare's play properly produced, it can still have a sense of popular appeal, even with the language, because he had a great sense of storytelling. He always knew that you needed to keep the action going. You needed to keep the groundlings happy. You carve out time for these great soliloquies. But, you know, you start with witches on the heath, or you start with ghosts being seen on the battlements. There's always something like, you know, or, you know, Romeo and Juliet, it's a big gang fight. Let's start with a gang fight. And I love that. I love the idea of, because for me, that's what I like about the novel. I don't think it's high art. I think there's artistic elements to it, but I think there's a lot of craft. And I think it's entertainment. I think we really do. You need to engage with the readers. You need to bring them along with you. You need to enjoy it as well. Even difficult things and difficult ways of expressing things, there should be a sense of allowing the reader in, making sure you don't lose your readers.
So with the character that we were talking about, Terry Rice, who is based on Tiresias, is that how it's pronounced in Greek? Tiresias?
I'm not on it.
Tiresias. Okay. So... and at the beginning of when they are first introduced in the book, they are presenting as a trans woman, correct?
Yes.
But then they decide to retransition. Why did you choose to do that?
I followed the Greek, because that's the story of Tiresias, that actually transitions from male to female and then comes back again.
Okay.
That's the interesting story for him.
And it is really interesting that I think most people who are so anti-trans and think it's this new thing and this fad are not aware of this long, long history.
There's always been culture. It's some form of transgender identity in cultures, and they manifest themselves in different ways. And the same way with gay and lesbian identity and bisexual identity. I mean, I think that again, I think for me, the important thing. I mean, obviously, there's all sorts of debates we go through and culture wars and things like that. But the fact is, these things exist, and they need to be.
and they're really just people.
Sorry?
They're really just people. They're all just people.
I mean, we share a common humanity, and that's the important thing. And that includes everything.
Yes.
And I think there's a very strong movement these days to other people because they're different or because they don't fit into your own idea.
Yeah.
And what people don't realize is within themselves, they're, you know, I always love, you know, what is it that Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, if we can't say that about ourselves, what kind of life we live, eh? If we just think that we've got some kind of...
How boring!
And I think that that's the tragedy of intolerance, is it's actually really, really limiting.
Oh, yes.
For everybody. And it comes out of all sorts of bitterness, I think.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Jake Arnott, author of Blood Rival. Jake, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your kind of writing process.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So do you have like a set time of day that you write, a set number of hours? Do you have a routine?
It's very hard to say, Monica. I think over the years, I've sort of adapted to what I'm working on and where I'm at that time. And I think before I was published, I probably had to be stricter than when I was writing full time, because I would have very set times when I was writing. But for a long time, I kind of thought, well, I can write, you know, I can free myself up. I don't need to worry about routine so much. It's more thinking about how I kind of construct this book, you know, how I'm going to build this book. And I think each book is different. For a long time, I would write more in the afternoon. And now I write much more in the morning. I don't know why. I've changed. I don't know what it is. I think, and every book has had a slightly different routine to it. With Blood Rival, I think, because I was writing it relatively quickly because I had an existing structure to work on. But I think with this one, I definitely found myself getting up early and getting quite a lot done, and then maybe maybe spending time, you know, having the afternoon for just looking at what I got.
Okay. So do you edit as you go?
I try to, but I also, you know, it's that you've got to be careful not to. Yeah, I do tend to do as much editing along while I'm going. I mean, I tend to, bizarre, it can sound laborious, but I tend to go through everything again, you know, when I not necessarily the whole book, but sometimes just go back to the beginning, go through the whole thing. It might take you a whole day, but it's worth it to see where you're at. And I think that's always been important for me. The most important thing for me, Monica, is the walk. I have to take a walk sometime during the day. And Friedrich Nietzsche said, never trust an idea that hasn't been proved by a walk. So I will often be working on something very particular, and I will take it for a walk. I will take a whole chapter, well, maybe not a whole chapter, but maybe a whole scene or a whole section I'm working on, and I will walk it through. And often that's when I get it really clarifies. It works in my head, and I can come back and I can put it all back. You know, it's almost the rhythm of it, and allowing my mind to I find it quite hard to think statically. I need to get out and walk it through.
Okay. Definitely. And you write on computer?
Yeah, I still make lots of notes.
Do you?
I make lots of notes. Yeah. I always think, for me, if I was a painter, this would be the equivalent of sketches.
Okay.
Because there's something about writing things out in longhand. It's scribbled notes that wouldn't mean anything to anybody else, and sometimes they don't mean anything to me because I'm literally writing fragments. It's little sketches, little snatches of dialogue, maybe a little phrase, maybe a word, maybe a whole sentence, and it's often all over the page. It's not necessarily. I'm not sure even what order it's going to be in. So I have lots. I get through lots of handwritten notes, and then I will start to construct it on the page.
Okay.
Types.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. In a way, almost a first, not draft exactly, but you start on paper before you go to the computer.
Sometimes I will just start writing something straight on the screen, and then but often when I'm thinking, I will just make, and things will come to me. And I will have lots of notes that I will start looking through and start constructing things from the little sketches I've got. And eventually I might have a paragraph, or I might have I might have an outline. I might have an outline of, you know, with little key bits in it.
Do you tend to write the book start to finish, or do you sometimes write a later scene and then come back and write an earlier scene?
Again, it depends on the book. I wrote a book called The House of Rumour, which is actually my last American deal. But that was a really big open plan book, and it had 22 sort of connecting chapters, and they're all based on the major arcana of the tarot pack. And so I would, with that, I was literally writing. It sent me mad. That's how it had to work. And I started right in the middle with that one. With Blood Rival, I started the book. I kind of knew the structure. Sometimes you have to build the structure and then find out what the structure is. With The Long Firm, it's funny because there's five different structures. My first published novel, five different very distinct voices. And I did work independently. There will come a time when you have to start going from start to end. Eventually.
Yes.
It's certainly how we read. It's generally how we read books.
Yeah.
Not always.
Yeah.
Always.
Well, and also not all books are chronological in the structure, it can be confusing when they're not sometimes.
Well, what you have to be is very clear about. I always say it's one of the things I say if I'm teaching. You have to be very clear about confusion, because of course. Confusion is very useful. It's a useful element in storytelling. You know, you can deliver, as long as you're deliberately, there's a deliberate confusion here. But if it's if it's not deliberate, then there's something wrong.
Right. That, yes.
That's the danger. Yeah.
So when you, how do you know when you're done?
You never know when you're done, actually. You kind of, I mean, you laughingly call it a first draft. You go through the first draft, you get someone to read it, you show it to your agent, and they'll have something to say. It's, you know, that's that old line, a work of art is never finished, merely abandoned. You get to that point where there's nothing more you can do. But I would, you know, I'd never try to give advice, because I don't think it's a very useful thing to give people, because people have to make up their own minds. But, you know, I would say never assume anything's finished. There's always something that you can do. And people will, I mean, if you have a good agent, or if you have a good editor, they'll let you know. Right. And if you have good readers around you as well, you need to kind of find the right people that can read your stuff.
So do you have an early reader, someone that you show things to before it goes to the agent?
Yeah. I mean, I've been lucky with my agents. I also, I often show stuff. I've got quite a big family. I'm very lucky in that respect. I've got a younger brother, and I'll often show him stuff, because the problem with showing friends is that sometimes you can end friendship. I've had friendships end with arguments over manuscripts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, you know, you never know with friends, because they could be telling you, I know that my younger brother's telling me the truth.
Right.
Because he does. He's just my brother. He's not going to think, oh, you're the great writer, or you're my friend. I might, you know, he'll always be my brother.
Right, right.
We've known each other for a long time, and I trust his judgment. And he'll just, it's like being kids, you know.
So, how did you find your first publisher? What was your path to publishing?
My path to publishing was very, very, you know, it's that famous line, how did you lose all your money? I started off losing it then very quickly. It's the other way around. I slowly had lots of rejection on my first book that it never got published. I sent that out, and it kept coming back. But with the long firm, interestingly, I felt it might have been a certain amount of the arrogance of youth, though I wasn't youthful. I was younger than I am now. But I knew that this, I was much more certain about this book. And I decided, rather than send it to lots of different agents, I found one agent. And this was before the internet or anything. I heard about this. I heard about Johnny Geller's like one of the big London agents now. But back then he was, he'd just started out. And there was something on the radio about him, because he'd been an agent's assistant at Curtis Brown, which is a big agency there. And his agent left the agency, and he was an agent's assistant without an agent. So he thought, I better look busy. And he started to read The Slush Pile. And he found a book on The Slush Pile and got a deal before he was an agent. And this was a big story. This is back in the 90s. This was the late 90s. And I thought, that's the person I want to represent me. So I sent it to him, and I sent him the whole manuscript. I didn't send him, I got in touch and said, I've got this book. I pitched it to him, and he said, I'll have a look. And he got back to me, and I went to see him. And I guess I was in the right place at the right time, Monica, because there was a lot of interest in that book.
Wow.
And we got a deal on the first day.
Wow.
You know. But this is the thing.
So you were an overnight success after 9 years.
It takes you 9 years to get to be an overnight success. I mean, it's very difficult. It's a hard process, and it's not any easier now. Now it's, in some ways, things have become much more, much tougher, much tighter in this country anyway, in Britain. It's, in some ways, there's easier ways. In those days, things were a little bit more of a mystery. Now you can find out agents online. They'll usually have a website. They'll usually have a profile of what they're looking for. And you have to remember, people are looking for submissions, but they're looking for the right submission. So never submit too early.
Mm.
Never think, oh, I just want to get this out there. I always count. If people start talking like that, you say, you know, they're in trouble, because it's almost, I almost feel unconsciously they're wanting to hurry up and get the rejection process over with. They don't realize that. No, but you know what I mean? It might need another draft. You really want to get to the stage where it's almost, you know, it's impossible to see what you can do.
Yeah. I mean, I do still believe, and I've talked to enough writers and enough debut writers that if the book is good enough, it will find a home.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, it's hard to say, but it's one of, I think with books, it's one of those things that I think so. Yeah. But you never know. You never know. It's tough. I wouldn't be able to judge now. I think the problem we have now is, in the UK anyway, is everything's become very, very categorized. Things have become very generic. Things have to be pitched in a particular way. Mm. And I think it's harder for things that maybe don't fit into a particular genre. I've always had that problem myself to a certain extent. And I think other writers it's even harder for. But it is tough. As I said before, if you don't love it, don't do it. Because otherwise it's going to be too hard. It's too hard. It's too much hard.
So really, if you're writing just to be published, it may not work.
No. That's the worst. That doesn't make any sense anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The thing is, you're writing to be read, and if you can read, the hardest thing is reading your own work, because I'll often, you know this, you'll read a manuscript, you think, well, they wrote this, but did they read it? Because it doesn't read very well.
Yeah.
People talk a lot about creative writing, but actually the creative process happens in the reading. That's the proof of the pudding. If it reads like that, that's when things actually happen. And I always read my work out loud. That really helps.
Yeah. Have you ever been part of a writing group where you read out loud to each other? Or
no. I you see, when I was starting, there wasn't so much of that around. Mm. And writing. I mean, it's funny, we're talking when we're about Iowa. I mean, we're in the beginnings of this notion of teaching creative writing. I mean, I remember, you know, Iowa was one of the few places where they actually did that.
Yes.
It was very, very, very influential. Yeah. I mean, when I had started writing, there was probably the University of East Anglia. It was about the only university that did it. Now every university has an MA in novel writing. And I think, you know, it's a good thing. And it's also, you know, it's also there's.
Well, I think one of the best things about doing that is that you're dedicating a certain amount of time to that, and you're paying for it, so you're maybe going to be more motivated to actually do the work of writing. It's like, was it Hemingway or something who said basically writing is a put your butt in the chair? And
well, he always stood up when he was writing.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it wasn't him. But Jake, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And we're out of time. I always end with a quote, and I wanted to do a quote from Greek mythology. And I found one that I thought was kind of fitting for this from Plato.
Uh-huh.
Love is composed of a single soul inhabiting two bodies.
Absolutely. Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth? And yes, and there is that sort of sense of a doomed love. Doomed love is one of the big themes in Blood Bible.
Thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.